Okay, one of the purposes of all of the Nisim in Mitzrayim, Torah tells us, Leman tesaper ba'ozne bincha uben bincha. Esa sher esalalti b'Mitzrayim v'yesol sosaya sher samti bom v'datem ki ani Hashem. In order that you should tell it over to your children and your grandchildren, into the ears of your children and your grandchildren, what I did in Mitzrayim and all the miracles that happened there, and then you'll really know that I'm Hashem. So, the question is, if every father has to tell his children, then why does a grandfather have to tell his grandchildren? Should say, you tell your children, and they'll tell their children. Why does a grandfather have to get involved? There are other answers to this question. I'm going to tell you what the Apiryon, who is Rav Shlomo Gansfried, the Machaber of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, wrote a Perush on Chumash called Apiryon. He asked this question, and I'm going to add another question, which his answer will answer also. And that is, why does the Torah have to be so graphic? Leman tesaper ba'ozne bincha. Say it into the ears of your children. And if it didn't tell me to tell their ears, I would tell their big toes. Of course you tell their ears. Where else do you speak to? So why did the Torah have to go out of its way to tell me ba'ozne bincha? Tell it to the ears of your children. Yetzias Mitzrayim is the foundation of our emunah. If you've learned the Kuzri, even didn't get past the Hakdama, you know that there he asked the following question. Is there any edge that our religion has over other religions? We believe in what we believe because our parents told us, and their parents told them. So there's a tradition. The same reason why Christians believe what Christians believe, because their parents told them, and their parents told them. The same reason why Muslims believe what Muslims believe. So is our belief only an accident of birth? We happen to be born Jews, so our parents told us what Jews believe. If we had been born Christians, we would have heard what Christians believe. Or is there some difference between our belief and their belief? The Kuzri says, and I see that I'm going off into this direction, which I didn't plan to do, but Kedai. Okay. The Kuzri says the following. There is a very significant difference between our belief and their belief, because if you trace the tradition back to its source, our source is a lot more credible than theirs. Meaning the following, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but you're going to hear it in a lot more detailed way now, which I didn't plan to do, but I just changed my mind. Trace Christianity back to its source, okay? I'm a believing Christian, and I believe it because my parents told me the foundations of Christianity that they got from their parents. Where did it start? It started with somebody coming, a man coming and claiming that he was the Son of God. And did anybody witness the fact that God gave out cigars when he was born? No. Did anybody know for sure God signed on the birth certificate? No. So he claimed to be the Son of God. Believe him, don't believe him. It's the word of one person. What are the other foundations of Christianity? Besides that, because he was the Son of God, he came to redeem the world and atone for sin, whatever, all that's his word. The other tenet of Christianity is that he died and came back from the dead, was resurrected. How many people saw that? So there, the New Testament itself, let's take their account, says that there were 12 of his disciples or 11 of his disciples that saw him come back, his close students, and a group of swooning women who were fainting at the time. Now, his disciples had a very strong vested interest to say that he came back, because if he didn't, they were out of a job. So their testimony is not exactly objective. women, with all the credibility that women have, but swooning women, when you're fainting, you could see who knows what. So they themselves say it was only witnessed by a group of people who had a vested interest in saying that they saw what they saw, even if they didn't, and a group of women who were very, very questionable how much they could be relied on, since it says they were fainting at the time. So the entire foundation of Christianity is based on the word of one man and something that a very small group witnessed. Those are the foundations of Christianity. So if you trace Christianity back to its source, very, very shaky foundation. Islam is even worse. The entire foundation of Islam is Muhammad said he had a dream in a cave that the angel Gabriel came to him and revealed to him the Quran and the entire new religion and told him to go out and spread the religion. Now, nobody shared the dream with Muhammad. Nobody videoed it. It's the word of one person that he had a dream. Maybe he had a stomachache that night, and he had a nightmare, right? Muhammad, however, had a very cogent philosophical argument that convinced many, many people to accept his religion. It went something like this: accept my religion or I'll cut off your head. Many people found that to be extremely convincing. So his religion spread like wildfire. And Christianity also spread, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted them to spread. So says the Rambam. The Rabban Shom had a reason why he wanted Christianity and Islam to be successful, to spread. It's not for now to discuss why. There are a few possible ideas. In any case, but the foundation, in other words, they have a tradition. My parents heard it from their parents, who heard it from their parents, all the way back to the source, but the source itself is very shaky. Now, if Judaism would have had the same source, same kind of source, then it would be on par with all the others. In other words, if Moshe and Aaron and his sister Miriam came to the Jewish people who were settled in Tel Aviv and said to them, you got to hear what happened to us. See, we were trekking through Egypt, and they captured us and enslaved us. And we worked very, very hard there for many, many years. And then all of a sudden, one day, God brought 10 plagues against the Egyptians. And we escaped from Egypt, and the Red Sea split for us, and we went to Har Sinai, and we got the Torah, and here it is. Believe us. Then our religion would be no better than theirs. It would be the word of a small group of people of what they saw, what they witnessed, and the foundation of our religion would be the same as theirs. But that's not what happened. Moshe Rabbeinu did not come and say, I saw this. I witnessed this. But he told them, you all saw this. You all were in Mitzrayim. You all saw the Eser Makos. You all saw Kriyas Yamsu. You all witnessed God speaking to all of you by Matan Torah. Now, there are only 5 possibilities of how that tradition came about. The first one is, it's true. It actually happened. The people actually witnessed all of that. They actually heard God speak. That makes our religion have a very, very strong foundation. There are 4 other possibilities. All of them are not impossible, but not plausible. Very, what's the word I'm looking for? Very, what? They're possible, but not, what? Unlikely. Okay, another word? Probable. That's the word I'm looking for. Possible, but not probable. Now let's see what the other possible, but not probable possibilities are. First one. Moshe Rabbeinu convinced an entire nation that they saw what they didn't see. He was a good speaker, very charismatic, and he convinced the whole generation there that they saw all these miracles, and they really didn't. But he convinced them they did. He really pulled something over on them. Very unlikely. It's possible, but very unlikely. Let me give you an example. If I would have come here tonight and said, I was white as a ghost, shaking, so really something really traumatic happened to me. And I tell you, listen, you're going to think I'm crazy, but I'm telling you this really happened to me. I was driving here, and on the way, I was on a deserted road, and all of a sudden, a flying saucer landed in front of my car. 10 little green men got out of the flying saucer, danced around my car, got back in the flying saucer, and took off. And I'm still shaking from the, and I'm telling you it really happened. I would imagine that some of you at least would have a doubt, maybe it happened. I mean, I'm not crazy. I've never told you things like this before. I may, Taka, be nuts, and you didn't know it before this, right? I may have hallucinated, but it's possible, right? You'd at least have a somewhat of a doubt, okay? However, if I came here tonight and said, do you all remember last week, in the middle of the class, a flying saucer came through the door, landed on the table, 2 little green men got out and danced around all of us, and got back in the flying saucer and took off, I don't think there'd be anybody here who would believe me or even have a doubt. Because I'm not telling you what I saw. I'm telling you what you saw, and you know you didn't see it. So I doubt very much in this class that there'd be anybody that would have a doubt. I'm not sure if in some other classes maybe there would be some people with doubts, but not surely not the majority. So for someone to convince people that they saw things that they never saw, very improbable, especially an entire nation, and especially Jews. It's hard enough to convince Jews they saw what they did see, let alone what they didn't see. As a rabbi, believe me, right, very difficult to convince Jews of anything. In fact, Rav Shaul Shofar Hirsch says it's one of the biggest proofs that the Torah is true, because we accepted it. Yes. Again, that could be more probable. Again, it's possible, it's possible. But is it probable if Moshe Rabbeinu would have come and said what he experienced, what he saw, the visions he saw, and they treated him like a god? Maybe. We see that that's not the case. They didn't treat Moshe Rabbeinu like a god. They rebelled against him. They made a golden calf when he didn't come back, right? They did tremendous, constantly complaining. So the Torah itself gives us an idea of who these people were. They didn't just swallow everything that Moshe Rabbeinu said. In addition to that, it wasn't just believe all these miracles, but accept a Torah that has a lot of restrictions that are very difficult to do. And if the people weren't 100% convinced that this is the real thing, then why in the world would they want to do all these crazy things? Yeah, I agree. No, it's possible for some charismatic person to convince people to do things, or even to accept things, or even to do things, crazy things. But to convince them that they saw things they didn't see, and base it on that, makes it even more unlikely. Okay. Again, possible, it's possible. Shaila is it probable? Second possibility. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't convince the people of that generation that they saw things they didn't see. But the people themselves made it up. It was a plot. They all got together and they made up all these things and foisted it on their children. They wanted to start a new religion, right? They were starting from scratch after being slaves. They wanted to have a glorious history, so they made it up. It was a plot. They all made it up. They didn't see it. They didn't witness it. They made it up and passed it on to their children. Again, if it would just be to create a nice history for our children is one thing. But they made up a lot of restrictions that are very difficult to do and went against the mores of society of the time. For instance, incest was an accepted thing at the time in Egypt. And these people made up a Torah that says you're not allowed to marry your relatives, which is totally against the accepted mores of the time. Another thing they made up, supposedly, is kashrus. Not to eat a lot of delicacies that were accepted eating things at the time. Also, they made up Yom Kippur, Taras HaMishpacha, and a million other things that are not easy to do. And they did this with the full knowledge that there's no purpose to it. And I'll tell you the truth. If I did not think that the Torah was divinely given, and it was made up by a bunch of people a few thousand years ago, there's no way in the world that I would put on little black boxes on my head and my arm at 5 o'clock in the morning, right? Just because somebody decided that's something to do 3,000 years ago. Unless I believe that God said to do it, and there is eternal benefit in putting those little black boxes on my head and my arm, right? No, you'd have to be out of your mind to do it because somebody decided. That means these people made it up. They knew there's nothing to it. They knew that they made it up. And they're telling their children to do all these things, knowing it's a hoax. What kind of parents are that? And yes, there are abusive parents in this world, but an entire nation of abusive parents? And usually people, before they die, get feeling guilty about things that they lied about. That's why a deathbed confession is accepted in court. People usually don't lie before they die. And therefore, don't you think that a good number of the people would call their kids together and say, know the black boxes? Forget about them. We made it up. Right? You know kashrus? We made it up. Forget about all those things. It's a hoax. So people would have, before they died, called their children together and told them that they made the whole thing up. Very improbable, therefore, that the tradition came to us as a hoax, started as a hoax. That's the third possibility. Of the two, except for that really happened, are improbable. Third possibility. It didn't happen. Nobody made it up. Nobody convinced people that it happened at the time. 1,000 years later, Ezra made the whole thing up and convinced the Jewish people that this happened 1,000 years before. So you don't have to convince people they saw things they didn't see. You just have to convince them that something happened 1,000 years before that they have no idea whether it happened or not. So Ezra had nothing to do one day. It was a rainy day, made up the whole Torah and convinced the Jewish people who were, you know, coming back from exile, and he had a reason to do it. He wanted them to have a glorious past, believe that you were slaves and God took you out and he gave you a Torah, and here it is. Sounds great. Also, very improbable. Because don't you think that somebody is going to raise his hand and say, if all these things really happened to our ancestors 1,000 years ago, then how come nobody ever heard of it? Because if it really didn't happen, nobody could have heard of it. That means Ezra introduced it to them without them ever hearing about it. So how could it be that you're the only one who knows about it, and for 1,000 years nobody ever heard of it? All of a sudden, you decide, imagine if I would come here tonight and tell you that I've discovered something that nobody knows. That between President Roosevelt and Truman, there was another president, or between Truman and Eisenhower, there was a President Cohen in America. Nobody ever heard of him. You never learned about him in American history, but I discovered him. Would anybody believe me? No. Why? Because if he really existed, how come nobody ever heard of him? How come there's no record of him? So somebody's going to raise their hand and say, Ezra, if it's really happened, how come we never heard about it? How come nobody said anything about it? Because if it never happened, nobody could know about it. And in addition, if Ezra just wanted to give them a glorious history, okay, maybe. So people say, what do we care? We'll accept it. But attacked along with that was a Torah that said, get rid of your non-Jewish spouses, and a host of other things they had to stop doing. Why in the world would they accept that and sacrifice so much out of their lives for something that they never heard of, nobody ever heard of, all of a sudden Ezra made up? Very improbable that an entire nation, yeah, you could have a few people that you could convince, but an entire nation can convince them of something that never happened, and all of a sudden you discovered it? So that's also improbable. There's one more possibility, which of all the improbable possibilities is the most probable of the improbables. And that's the following. It happened, but not the way the Torah said. Yeah, there were a bunch of Jews who were working overtime in Egypt. and they made a strike, and they ran away, and as they were running away, they ran, jumped over a puddle, and they made up some laws, and over 1,000 years of getting told over and over, the little sardine turned into a whale, and the puddle turned into a sea, and the sea split, and that's how they got through, and it changed. Things changed. You ever play the game? In America, they call it telephone. In England, they tell me they call it Chinese whispers. You ever play the game? What's the game? You have 10 people standing in a line, and you whisper something to the first person or give them a piece of paper to read it to themselves. And then you tell them, pass it on to the next person. And they whisper to the next person what the first person whispered to them. And then the next one. When you get to the 10th person, usually the message is completely different than what you started out with. And it's always good to try to guess what the original message was from what the last message was if it's not the same. Things change. If they change in 10 people, surely they change over thousands of years. So, Metzias Mitzrayim happened, but not the way that we know it. And over 1,000 years, it changed until we have the version that we have with Kriyas Yam Suf or whatever, but it started in a very, very uneventful way. What is improbable about that? Tell you. If that is what happened, then it should be comparable to the following case. You have 100 people playing telephone, 10 lines of 10 people deep. Line 1, 2, 3, back 1A, 1B, 1C, and so on, till 1I. And 2A, 2B, 2C. Okay. These are the givens. The same message, we know for sure, was given to all the people in row 1. 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A, all heard the same message. We don't know what it was, but we know for a fact that it was all the same. That's a given. Just as all the people who witnessed whatever it was that happened in Mitzrayim saw the same thing. Either they saw people jumping over a puddle, or they saw a sea splitting. But whatever they saw, they all saw the same thing. That's a given. Now, we go to the people on the end of the line, number 10, 10A, 10B, 10C, and so on. And we ask them, what did you hear? What was passed on to you? And they all say the same thing. Now, there's two possibilities. What was started was preserved perfectly and got to the 10th people exactly as it was. It started all the same, it ended all the same, the same thing. What started, what ended is the same thing. Or there's another possibility. It changed 10 times, but the same way. It's not the same thing as it started. It changed. But it changed independently 10 times the exact same way. Which is more probable? The first one. Because if it changed, there should be 10 versions, 8 versions, 6 versions. Not one version in the end. Because if it changed, it was very improbable that it changed 10 times independently the same exact way. So, meaning that if the tradition started differently and over thousands of years changed, it should have changed in different places, different ways. There should be 100 different traditions, 10 different traditions. There should be a tradition that says that we went through the Yam Suf and the sea split. Another tradition that says we went scuba diving under the water. Another one that says we flew over the waters. Another one said that it was a puddle. The other one says that it was, if it started with a puddle and changed to the splitting of the Red Sea, then if it changed, there should be 100 different changes. We're not talking about one line. We're talking about parents to children and students to teachers and spread out over a whole land. If people changed it as they gave it over, then there should be somewhere different opinions. And even though in details of exactly how Kriyas Yam Suf happened, there are different medrashim, but nobody argues that Kriyas Yam Suf, that it was Yam Suf and it split or whatever. We're talking about the foundation, the basic things. There aren't more than one tradition. There never was. Even those who claim that they don't believe in the tradition, the tzedukim, the karoyim, the conservative, reform. They don't claim to have another tradition. They just don't believe in the tradition. They don't claim to have another one. There's a famous story told of that brings out this point. It's a joke, but it's a, I doubt if it's a true story, that in Muslim countries, the Muslims gave rights to the various dhimmi communities, Christians and Jews, to take care of their own needs, their own communal needs. And they were able to have their own hierarchy and their own structure, infrastructure. But they only allowed one group per religion. So when the Karoyim claimed to be the authentic Jews and the Rabbanim claimed to be the authentic Jews, they only allowed one group to be the one that ruled the Jewish community. So what happened in many cases that the Karoyim and the Rabbanim had a debate in front of a caliph, and the caliph had to decide who he thinks is the authentic Jews and who he conferred the rights of communal leadership on, the Karoyim or the Rabbanim. So the story goes that there was once a debate between a Karoy and a Rav in front of a Muslim caliph to decide who is going to have the rights, the communal rights for that community. So they both come before the caliph, and as is customary by Muslims, they take off their shoes, leave them, the Karoy left them in the outside antechamber, walks into the throne room of the caliph barefoot, and presents himself before the caliph. The rabbi takes off his shoes and holds them in his hand and brings them, holding them in his hand in front of the caliph. So the Karoy says to the caliph, how could you possibly think that this rabbi is an authentic Jew? Look what a boor he is. He doesn't even know he's supposed to leave your shoes outside. He's standing here like an idiot holding his shoes in front of you. How could you possibly think that he represents the authentic Jewish people? So the caliph looks at the rabbi and he says, could you explain yourself? Why are you standing in front of me holding your shoes? He said, I really apologize if it's insulting, but we have a tradition that makes it mandatory for us to hold our shoes. He said, what? He said, see, our first prophet, Moshe Rabbeinu, was called to the burning bush, and God told him to take off his shoes. So he took off his shoes, and he left them where they were, and he went to speak to God by the burning bush, and when he went back, he found out that his shoes were missing. And after searching for them, he found out that a Karoy stole his shoes. And therefore, whenever we are in the presence of Karoyim, we hold on to our shoes. That's our tradition. The caliph looks at the Karoy and he says, what do you have to say to that? He says, that's ridiculous. There were no Karoyim in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. End of debate. Any case, so there were never other traditions. They don't claim to have another alternative tradition. They just don't believe in the tradition. They say it didn't happen. But there was never another alternative tradition. So it's very improbable that if it changed, there should be 10, 15, 20 different traditions, and there aren't. And therefore, it probably didn't change. Now, the only problem is, then why is it probable that it didn't change? It always changes when you play telephone. So why didn't it change over thousands of years? The answer is the following. Let me give you another example. Imagine 100 people walking through the jungle, okay? And in 1 second, they all sink into the mud to their waist. And they are evenly spaced, where they can only communicate with the person in front of them and behind them. They're out of earshot of anybody else, okay? Number one and number two are very close to each other, though. They have physical contact. And number one, all of a sudden, has some kind of seizure. Number two has no idea what to do for number one, but it looks like if he doesn't do something fast, the guy's going to die. So he says to number three, he calls out to number three, it's the only one he can communicate with, I'm going to describe to you what's happening to number one. And I want you to pass it on, because number 100 is a doctor. And when it gets to number 100, I want him to hear the symptoms and pass back one by one what I should do with this guy. So the message goes from 2 to 3 to 4, the symptoms. The doctor hears it and says, do X, Y, and Z, and it goes back now, 99, 98, all the way back to number two. Do you think the message will change on either side?
No.
Why not?
Because
it's serious. Because people know that somebody's life depends on it. Okay? It's not a parlor game. In the game, it's fun that it should change. Over here, it's not going to be very fun if number one dies, unless you don't like him. But in any case, so people take it seriously. People passing on this tradition, passing over this tradition, get the pun in there, when they passed over this tradition, they knew that not only did their lives depend on it, but their eternal life depended on it. They took it very seriously, and therefore it didn't change because it was very serious. It wasn't a parlor game. And if it had changed, again, it was more probable that it would change many ways than just one monolithic way. So therefore, of all the possibilities, the one that is most probable, even though all of them are possible, that's why there's a mitzvah of emunah, because you have to believe. It's not something you can prove. If anybody tells you that you can prove anything that you have to believe, don't believe them. Because if you could prove it, like you could prove an equation and there'd be no way out, then there'd be no mitzvah. There's no bechira. There has to be a place to make a mistake. But if you want to believe, and you don't want the dafka not to believe, then the probability of this tradition being true based on how it originated, the probability is that it's true. That is Yetzias Mitzrayim. And therefore, wasn't there. So how do I know that it happened? Because I heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody who was there. There's an unbroken chain of tradition. If you break that chain, then what's it called? Then all of this means nothing. It's only because somebody told me, who heard from somebody, who heard from somebody who was actually there. That's what strengthens this tradition. There's an unbroken chain. What makes it even stronger is that the first link in the chain was very, very strong, as opposed to other religions where the first link was very weak. And therefore, the Torah says the following. Pesach night, when you have to tell over Yetzias Mitzrayim, or whatever, you tell over Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, you are not telling a story. You are creating a link in a chain for the future, that this chain of tradition shouldn't be broken. Because if it's broken, then for the future, you are destroying, to a certain degree, the validity and the credibility of our tradition. So every generation has a responsibility to pass this tradition over to the next generation, and the coming generation has a responsibility to receive it. And therefore, you can't just tell it as a story, but you have to tell it in a way, says the Apirion, that your child will understand it and accept it and give it over to his child. Because if you don't give it to him in a way that he's interested and capable of giving it over to the next generation, you haven't created a link and a chain. You've just told him a nice story, and that's not the purpose. The purpose is to make him a link in the chain for the future. And therefore, I think it says to tell it to his ears. The Ritva says, "Keneged arba bonim dibra Torah," right? The four sons of the Haggadah. Without the Haggadah, I wouldn't know that there's different kinds of kids. Why do I need the Haggadah to tell me there's different kinds of children? Says the Ritva, because if I don't tailor make the story to fit the personality and IQ, intelligence, of my specific child, I'm not yotzei the mitzvah. Because the mitzvah is not to tell him a nice story. It's to make him a link in a chain of tradition. And therefore he has to be able to understand it. He has to be able to accept it according to his personality and want then to pass it on to the next generation. Therefore, it's not that the grandfather has to tell his grandchild. You have to tell your child in a way that it'll get to your grandchild. That's what you have to do. You have to tell it to him in a way, L'mantasafer bosne bincha, that it should get to ben bincha. That's your responsibility. Create a link in the chain. And therefore, you have to tell it to his ears. You have to make it tailor-made to his personality. If you tell a Rasha the same kind of style that you tell a tzaddik, you're not going to get through to him. And they are vice versa. If you tell a story that's fit for a chacham to a tam, it's going to be over his head. And if you tell the chacham what's fit for a tam, it's going to bore him to death. You have to make the story fit your child's intelligence and personality. That's keneged arba bodim dibra Torah. That's why the Torah says, l'man tesaper bo'ozne bincha u'ben bincha. You have to see to it that you give it to your child in a way that he can accept it and pass it on. And therefore you have to tailor-make it to go into his ears specifically, not stop some generic story that goes equally into everybody's ears. That is my estimation, and based on this apirion, of what this pasuk means. Okay, that wasn't supposed to take us so long, but I think there was a benefit in it. Okay, next, another important thing. It says, when Moshe Rabbeinu was originally told how they're going to leave Mitzrayim, he was told that before they leave Mitzrayim, they should get gold and silver and clothing. When Moshe told the people, he only mentioned the gold and the silver. And when it actually happened, it says they took gold and silver and clothing. Strange. Why, first of all, why in the world would God tell Moshe to tell Jewish people to take clothing? Egyptian clothing? And what to do with it? Put it on your kids. Strange thing. Because one of the merits we had to leave Mitzrayim was Loshinu es Malbusha. We didn't wear Egyptian clothing the whole time we were in Egypt. We wore Jewish clothing. We didn't wear Egyptian clothing. It's one of the merits that we had. So it's interesting, just as an aside, in parentheses, because we're all wearing, well, not all of us, but all of you, are wearing Egyptian clothing, right? Regular clothing of what's it called, of the same clothing that your non-Jewish counterparts wear. Can't tell from your clothing that you're Jewish. Me, maybe, but you not, right? So how come you can do that? So Moshe Feinstein says an interesting thing. He says that before the Torah was given, that which created the identity of a Jew was how they dressed, what their names were, what language they spoke. But after the Torah was given, the Torah creates the identity of a Jew. How a Jew talks, not what language. How he eats. How he dresses, not necessarily the mode of clothing, but tznius or whatever. So we have Torah to give us an identity. It's not therefore so important anymore that we dress completely different than the goy or whatever. But that's where Moshe Feinstein says. Okay, in any case, but that was one of the merits we had, that we didn't dress in Egyptian clothing. Now we're going out of Egypt, and God tells us to take Egyptian clothing, put it on your kids. And why is it mentioned when God told Moshe originally? Not when Moshe told it to the people, but when they actually did it, then they were told to take clothing too. Why the difference? So there's a kliyoker. It's not what I want to tell you, but I'll tell you the kliyoker anyway. The kliyoker says like this. Really, there was no command to take clothing. But God knew that when they went to get gold and silver, the Egyptians were going to offer them clothing too. And that's what happened. Why? Because after Makas Bechoros, the Egyptians thought that the Bechoros died in a plague. After you have a plague, what's the first thing you do? Burn the clothing. Because you think it's infected. And it is going to infect people with the plague. So the Egyptians, when the Jews came for gold and silver, said, why don't you have some clothing with it, thinking they're going to infect us with the plague. God said, don't worry, take the clothing. You can even put it on your kids, it's safe. No plague killed their children, I killed their children. So the clothing is not infected at all. So don't worry about taking it. That's what happened. It wasn't a command to take the clothing. God just foretold to Moshe that when they get to gold and silver, the Egyptians are going to offer them clothing, and don't worry about it, you can take it, it's not infected. Okay, that's the kliyoker. I have a different pshat. And even if my pshat is not emes in the pshat in this pasuk, which I think it is, it's 100% emes in idea. in concept. And that's the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to teach us a lesson that is important for all generations. And that is the following. He wanted us to know that Egyptian clothing was 100% glatt kosher. There was nothing in the Shulchan Aruch that would prohibit wearing that clothing. The proof is, I want you to wear it in the desert, put it on your children. If it would be not sneistic, how could you put it on your children? If it would be shatnez, how could you put it on? Anything that could be wrong with clothing wasn't wrong with it. Because you could wear it. But had you worn that same glatt kosher clothing the last 210 years in Egypt, you wouldn't have gone out. Why not? Because in Egypt, you would be wearing it to be like a goy. And that is treif, even though there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. When I was in high school, the rage in the world were the Beatles, not the six-legged variety, the two-legged variety, the rock band from Liverpool. And I was in a yeshiva high school in the Sifta, and the Beatles started a fad in the world that didn't exist before them. Before the Beatles, the only men that had long hair were hippies, bohemians, right, bums, people who couldn't afford a haircut. Those were the only men who had long hair. But the Beatles, right, who were the rage of the world, they had long hair, especially the drummer Ringo Starr had long hair. So it became a fad amongst respectable men to grow their hair long. Men's hairstyles changed, and men started growing long hair. Lawyers, doctors, businessmen, respectable people, not hippies. And whatever affects the non-Jewish world eventually affects the Jewish world. So in my high school class, some of my friends stopped taking haircuts. And after about 3 or 4 months, it started looking like a co-ed school. And one Friday, I remember, I never had a penchant for growing long hair. It wasn't me. But some of my friends did. And I remember one Friday, the Rebbeim called these boys in and told them in no uncertain terms that they are to go get a normal men's haircut for Shabbos. And if they do, then they're welcome to come back on Sunday. And if they don't, then they are suspended, and until they get a normal haircut, they can't come back to school. That was what they told me. My friends were not daunted by that. And they said to the Rebbeim, but Rebbe, a Nazir grows his hair long and he's holy. We just want to be holy people with long hair. Then they said, did you ever see a picture of the Ragachover Gaon? He was the Rav in Dvinsk. He was the Chassidish Rav, and the Or Sameach, Rav Meir Simcha, was the Litvish Rav. The Ragachover was a genius. I mean, a genius that they say was beyond Einstein. Even some of the things that he writes are mamish, the theories of relativity, where mamish Einsteinian things that he saw in Torah. In any case, he was a super genius. But they say that he never wanted to stop learning, so he didn't want to take off his yarmulke to get a haircut. So he didn't take a haircut. And he had a gigantic head of hair. They see pictures of it. So they said, Rebbe, we just want to be like the Ragachover, right? We just want to have big hair like the Ragachover. My Rebbeim were not daunted by that, and they said, haircut or don't come back on Sunday. Why? Because it may be that there is nothing halachically wrong with a man having long hair. And a Nazir can be holy and have long hair, and the Ragachover can have long hair. But if the reason you're growing long hair is to be like the Beatles, that is treif. You don't only judge things by their intrinsic value. You have to judge them by their meaning, their message, their import, according to the time and place where you are. And therefore, it's very possible that in one place something could be 100% mutter, and in another place 100% awesome. Because in the first place it doesn't stand for anything, in the second place it stands for something. I'll give you another example. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so I decided that I'm going to be an Israeli for certain things, and one of those things is my first sukkah. I came in Elul. My first sukkah, I am going to decorate my sukkah, not with my Chutz La'aretz sukkah decorations. I'm going to get all new Israeli sukkah decorations. So I went to Meir Sharim, to Geula, to buy sukkah decorations about 28 years ago. And I get close to the streets where their tables line the streets. You know what Geula looks like, the sukkah type? And they're selling sukkah decorations. And as I get closer, it looks really strange because these look very familiar. And as I get even closer, it's even stranger because they are very familiar. They're Christmas decorations in the original packaging that says Merry Christmas on it. And all these Yerushalmis are buying it like it's, you know, wow, great sukkah decorations. I was sure that I would go Chol HaMoed to Meir Sharim and see a sukkah with a little baby and a lot of shepherds around or whatever. And they would tell me, wow, look, beautiful sukkah decoration, ganze mishpacha, whatever. Now, these Yerushalmis had no idea that these were Christmas decorations. They never saw a Christmas tree. They never saw a Christian. Even the goyim that are around are only Muslims. And at that time, there surely were no Christmas trees in Eretz Israel. Now that there's Russians here, there's plenty of Christmas trees. But it used to be you didn't see a light, you didn't see a Christmas tree. Nobody knew who these people were, where they were. I once, well, we were going to Chutz La'aretz, myself and another person, to recruit for our moshav. And it was around this time of year. So my friend told his little six-year-old boy, he said to him, you should know, you're lucky I'm going now, because after Christmas, there are a lot of sales, toy sales, and I'm going to buy you something nice. And the kid looked at him and said, what's Christmas? He never heard of it in his life. Never. To the point where Purim, they have a picture of it. There was a family, a Meir Sharim family, dressed up as Santa Claus. They never know who he is. I have a daughter, my little daughter, who's now a mother, but when she was about 6 years old, they used to have here American Week in the supermarket, where they bought in American products. Now they have them all the time. So my wife bought my children a treat, Quaker Oats. Okay, you know what the Quaker Oats look like with the Amish guy on the thing? My daughter comes running to me after davening. I come home from davening. She comes running to me. Tati, Mommy bought cereal with the Kalava Rebbe on it. They have no idea what it is. I'm sure if a Yerushalmi went to America around this time of year, they would say, hey, those guys stole our sukkah decorations. So here in Eretz Israel, maybe nothing wrong with using Christmas decorations for your sukkah. But in America, it could be also 100% because there you're doing it and you're like a goy. So what one place may be 100% mutter, maybe usher in another place. Because it's not intrinsically wrong, it's wrong because of what it stands for. And therefore in one era, in one time, something may be mutter and another time usher. You know that in the yeshivas, during the Haskalah, in Lithuania, whatever, they stopped learning Chumash, they stopped learning Tanakh. Because the Haskalah said that Tanakh is the only thing important in Torah, Torah Shebaal Peh is not important. And they substituted Torah Shebaal Peh with Tanakh. So Tanakh became a symbol of Kfira. They stopped learning Tanakh in yeshivas. The backlash is even till today. But that's where it started. So something could be 100% kosher v'yosher. But if in that place it stands for something, that's what the Rebbe Shlomo teaches us. You can wear Egyptian clothing in the desert, there's nothing wrong with it. But if had you worn that same clothing in Egypt the last 210 years, you never would have gone out. Because in Egypt, it would have been to be like a goy. That's straight. In the desert, there's no Egyptians around. Nothing wrong with the clothing. As long as intrinsically, there's nothing wrong halachically. It's not shatnez. It's not sonua. Then wear it. That's the idea. Okay. I had about 10 things to do. We did 2. Okay.